everyone, welcome to a new episode of Caroline Talks, the podcast slash YouTube channel where I, your host, Caroline Hines, film critic and journalist, speak to film creatives around the world about their work, the industry, and what inspires them. And today, this is going to be my first interview for my coverage of South by Southwest Film Festival for this year. And I'm very happy to be joined by filmmaker Julie Lynn Lillister to talk about her film, An Army of Women. It's a documentary about a group of women who filed a class action lawsuit in Austin against the Austin PD, as well as the district attorney and assistant district attorney of, I looked it up, Travis County in Austin, because I actually did some reading on the court cases and stuff. So I think it's very interesting that the film is about this particular court case and who they filed the court case against. So I'm very interested to talk to you about that. So thank you, first of all, for joining me, Julie.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the film kind of begins in 2018, I would assume, because that's the year the class action lawsuit was filed. And it was by a group of women and their two lawyers who came together and said, you know what, we're fed up with the system and how the system is victimizing victims of sexual assault and sexual crimes. So tell me how you became involved with this situation, because you're in Norway. And this film and everything is set in Austin, Texas. So tell me, how did you learn about the case and what made you decide you wanted to document this entire journey of this group of women?
Sure. So I was living in Austin at the time. My husband is American, and so I moved there to live with him. And I had lived in Austin for about a year when I learned about this lawsuit on the local news. And I was really surprised to hear about it. Because I think, you know, I didn't know that it was this bad. I thought that sexual assaults were taken seriously. You know, it's probably a very naive view, but I really thought that the system was set up in a way that assaults were handled properly, and, you know, that they were really trying to make sure it wouldn't happen again. And then I heard about the lawsuit, and I learned that very, very, very few cases ever even made it to trial. And so I was really shocked at how much the system was failing. And then there didn't seem to be anyone in the DA's office or the police department who seemed that interested in changing it. There was a lot of pushback against the lawsuit. So I became interested in following the lawsuit to find out whether or not these survivors could succeed. And whether they could actually bring this change that the city and the U.S. as a whole desperately needed.
So how did you, once you decided you wanted to learn more about this, when what was the moment you said, you know, I'm going to make a documentary about this, especially knowing that it would last years, because class action lawsuits generally take years. And those especially, and this is one that was basically a groundbreaking case, because they were going both against the police department, but also the city and the city's district attorney. So this is a very rare case, and it's one where, you know, like, if they win, it's going to take years, and like the end result might not be what anyone involved would want. So what made you decide, okay, I'm going to make a documentary about this for sure? And what was your process of getting in contact with the lawyers, Elizabeth and Jenny, and like, what was your process in getting in contact with them?
You know, I think I didn't know that much about how class action lawsuits work. So maybe if I did, I wouldn't have started this project, because I didn't know that it would take that long. You know, when I first learned about the lawsuit, it had been going on for 1 year, and they were still just waiting for a judge to make a decision about whether or not they could move forward. And so I was like, okay, it might be a year or two. Like, I didn't know how long the process would actually be. But I did feel like, you know, reading that lawsuit and learning about the case, I felt like, as a woman, I felt really angry, and I felt like people needed to know about this. I saw that these survivors were really, you know, screaming and trying to get people's attention, and a lot of people weren't listening. And so I felt like something I can do, my skill is in documentary filmmaking. And this is something I can do to help bring attention to this issue. I also found it very I find it interesting to follow a process like this because you don't know the outcome. And
Right.
so it really is a story where the odds are against them, which I think makes it more of an interesting story, because you always know that they can fail at any time. So I reached out to Jenny and Elizabeth, the lawyers, and asked if they wanted to meet with me. And we had a meeting and talked, and I learned about the work that they were doing, and then the work that all of these plaintiffs were doing. And they were the ones that called them, they said, there's an army of women here that are working really hard, trying to change things kind of behind the scenes. And so they then introduced me to Marina and Hannah, who became the main protagonist of the film. And when I met them, that's when I realized that, if I can film with these two protagonists and the lawyers, I really do have a really powerful film because they were so interesting people.
Yeah, Marina, Garrett and Hannah Senko. So they're the ones who created Amy's Army Initiative, which is to get women and men involved in doing advocacy for sex crimes, but also working with the police departments and the attorneys and the prosecutors and the courts to not only prosecute crime, sexual crimes, but also the way the process in which they handle them. Because like you have like people who are police officers and people who work in the police departments who aren't trained to speak to women who've been sex, oops, women, or I should say women and men who've been sexually assaulted. They're not trained in how to be careful in the words they say and the things they do, how to give them space and to treat them as survivors of a very traumatic events. And the initiative is all about that. And it's all about getting ad and getting people involved in the movement. But Marina and Hannah are very interesting because Marina, her assault happened when she was 19, and she'd been fighting since that age, since she was in college, to be heard. She'd been fighting for years to be heard and to be acknowledged by the judicial system. And Hannah was interesting because in the film, you introduced the women involved in the class action lawsuit. It's about 10, it's more than 10 women, and you named some of them, and I'll read off some of the names. So like there's Hannah, Angela, Amanda, Kelly, Marina, and one who is Amy Smith, who is that's the pseudonym that she used because she was worried for her safety and the safety of her family and her daughter. And that's where they got the name of Amy's army. But I thought Hannah was interesting because she was the one that was considered no name within the lawsuit. She's the one that wasn't named. And I thought it was interesting throughout the film where you see her courage develop. And where she became more confident in herself as a woman, but also in the confidence in her, I should say, her identity as a survivor. And she learned a lot from these women that she interacted with, especially Marina, because Marina was the youngest, but she was so vocal and she really inspired these women. So talk about I want to talk about Amy Smith a little bit, but I want you first to talk about Marina and Hannah and focusing the film on them. Of course, you give space to the other victims, but those were the two main focal points with regards to the victims.
Yeah, I think they're a great there's a big contrast between them, which I really liked. I met both of them at the same time, and the differences between them really struck me. Their background is very different, their age is different, and their types of assaults are very different. Marina was, as you said, very outspoken and loud and kind of demanded justice in a way. And she had already been, when I met her, she was 24, so it'd been almost 5 years that she had been advocating and speaking out and really, talking about her very traumatic assault. Whereas Hannah, when I met her, she had been doing advocacy work, but not so much about her own experience. She hadn't really talked about her own assault. And hers was an assault that happened by, she was date raped by a man she went on a date with. And so it was, an acquaintance. And I think the response that she got when she reported that rape from the criminal justice system made her feel like she should, there was nothing there. She should just bury that assault. There was nothing she could do. She shouldn't expect justice. And so I was really interested in the two of them as kind of lead protagonists because Marina was already out there and doing a lot of things. And And with Hannah, I knew that she was not yet a named plaintiff in the lawsuit, but that potentially she could be if it was needed. And so I wanted to kind of see where that went with her. So yeah, so to me, I think they were a really wonderful kind of duo, and they also become close friends towards the end of the film, which is really beautiful.
Right, and the differences between the two of them are very stark. As you mentioned, there's like also there's their, I guess you would call them like there's, I don't like using the term status, but like that's how people look at them, because Marina was more working class, whereas for Hannah, she obviously came from a more affluent background, and it shows like how there's certain things that removes all lines of division, and one of these things is sexual assault. Like doesn't matter what your race is, you know, what your gender is, what your educational or financial background, where you live, sexual assault is something that can happen to anyone, and it does happen to anyone. And the film, in like, it's not pointed out, but that's something that was occurring to my in to me as I was watching, because all of the women that you that are interviewed in the film like come from vast walks of life, you know, like none of them look alike. Everyone has very different personalities. Everyone has very different physical traits and backgrounds and hobbies and everything, and it shows how pervasive sexual assault is and rape is in not just in North America but in society. And I'm from the Caribbean, and it's a huge problem in the Caribbean. And it's the same where it's not really prosecuted, you know, because like it's not, it's kind of treated I don't like, coming from the Caribbean, I would say like sometimes we don't even name things as sexual assault. You know, you'll just say, oh, like this really bad thing happened. And the words like rape or sexual assault and sexual crimes aren't really labeled with these acts, you know. And it's kind of the same where it is in North American society, where like, you know, you would grow up hearing, oh, boys will be boys, you know. Like, you know, if a boy does this thing, he likes you. You know, if he shows you that he's mean, he likes you. You know, like boys are taught this way. And then girls, we are taught, dress a certain way, you know, dress modestly, you know, don't be too coquettish, or don't be too inviting in our speech and the things we say. Don't smile. They tell us to smile so we look like, you know, we are appealing, but then don't smile too much. Don't smile for too long. You know, don't look at them in the eye for too long, because then that's showing interest. But we're taught on ways to give in to their to patriarchy and to men's dominance, but men aren't taught not to rape,
I
you
know, I know.
know. Like they're
You're
not
so
taught like
right.
to they're not taught to respect our sexual autonomy. They're not taught to respect us as human beings, as people. You know, the onus is always on women and on the victims to not get raped, instead of telling men just don't be a rapist. You know, just don't be violent. And in the film, like something that is really interesting is one of the claimants, one of the people that they are, as I mentioned at the beginning, that the case is against is the DA, who is a woman, Margaret Moore, and her assistant, who is also a woman. And in like there's clips that you show with how she speaks, you know, she says, I do this, you know, I prosecute cases and all this stuff. And she made me curious, because I actually went and looked up online to see if any other cases were actually brought against her, and there were. Like the case from this class action lawsuit wasn't the first case filed against her for prosecutorial misconduct and for basically gender bias in her work. There's another claimant who did the same thing, and she eventually joined the class action lawsuit. And I thought it was interesting. It shows a pattern, but it also shows how women internalize misogyny and how women are also protectors of sexual assaulters. So talk to me about that aspect of the film, because the film does show that women are victims, but also women actively uphold the system of oppression.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is so true, sadly, that like there is this system of oppression and all these biases that we have against women, and they are so internalized that, prosecutors have them, detectives have them, jurors have them. And so when a detective investigates a case, they have certain ideas about how a woman should act or behave. And then they think about, what would the jury think about this woman? Will they believe her? And so it's like it really pervasive across all these layers, and it is what is stopping so many women from getting justice. And it was surprising to me to, to see that the DA in Austin, who this class action lawsuit is against, is a woman, and she's a Democrat. She's not, she's a Democrat woman, but even so, I think there are all these biases inherent in the system that make it really, really hard for women to get justice. And so that was, of course, it's quite sad, but I think the lawsuit and what they were able to do gave me a little bit of hope, at least, that things can be changed.
Yeah, things can be changed because the lawsuit was settled. It settled in 2021, and they were able to not, of course, get a monetary payout for everything that they've been put through, but they were able to get some changes in the system there. And I want to talk about that a bit, but then in also talking about female bias, can you talk a bit about how, as you said, because when you began filming, when you began looking into the case before you even began filming, you said you had a preconception of how the justice system in America worked, and like that idea was kind of shattered in an instant when you really looked at when you started to reading to the case. I would assume reading into other cases similarly, and so you had that kind of like bias about American society and American judicial culture. And how did you personally handle these revelations and this reality when you once you started to talk to the women involved in the film, but also doing your own research as a filmmaker and in like even in maybe perhaps editing the film? Because like as we said, it took years, you know, it took years for this case to come to an end. And even afterwards, that like, you cover some stuff that happened after the settlement. And what was your, how did you handle your own biases being shattered and broken?
I mean, yeah, I think unless you have reported a rape or know someone who has, I think you have this idea. And it might be, me coming from Norway, where I would say, I would say in Norway, like I have sort of like an inherent trust in the police in Norway. And so I had this idea that like the criminal justice system is here to protect us. And then, when I came to Austin and I learned about the lawsuit and I realized that like it's not really set up to protect women. And of course, with Black Lives Matter protests and everything happening over the course of filming, it's like a real revelation to understand that the policing in the US is quite broken. And so that was I think I used the revelations when I from reading the lawsuit to kind of fuel my anger as I was making the film, because it was a long process. It was almost 4 years of filming, and so you need something to kind of drive you to get through that. And so I think I used sort of the anger that I felt to push through and to make sure that we got to make this film. And then in editing, I would say that it was important to make sure that viewers, because I think a lot of viewers do not know that this is the reality. So we wanted to make sure that, for when you see this film, you will get upset and shocked at these numbers. But then you will also see that it's possible to do something about it.
Yeah, it's I think the film does serve as a I think as a way of inspiration of showing women and men and victims of sexual assault, but also their supporters that the process is long and hard and arduous and it might not be worth it in the end, whereas like getting like the settlement, it was rare. That was the very first time any settlement like that had ever been done in the US. And like even if the process doesn't end the way you want, the process itself is what matters because these women grew so much over the course of the case. You know, like for Marina in particular, she matured so much. You know, she became like in the beginning of the film, it was so interesting to see how she was like, she had to do this public speech and she was very nervous. and very doubtful of herself, and like very, like she was looking at her phone for her notes and everything, and she was very nervous and she needed a lot of assurance. But by the end of the film, it's like a full on 80, she's more self-assured. She has no problem speaking up publicly, she's able to smile and she's able to like command attention. And like, as I mentioned earlier, there was Hannah. She herself, she doubted if she was the right type of victim to be named in the lawsuit. That was one of the reasons she said she didn't want to be named, because she thought she wasn't the right type of victim and that her case didn't qualify, because there are people in the judicial system say, oh, you're not the right type of victim, say, oh, we can't really prosecute your case because you don't really fit these particular check boxes, and that plays on a victim's mind. That played on her mind and made her doubt herself as a person and made her doubt what she experienced, and that in itself is traumatizing, having to look at your experience from the perspective of people who don't understand, and having them say, oh, you're not good enough as a victim, which is insane to say. And so she went through her own evolution. And then I would say the other main character is Amy Smith. That's the pseudonym. And it was I as I was watching, I was wondering, are we gonna learn her real name? And then at the end, we do. And I thought the way that it's revealed, the way how you chose to reveal it in the film, and the way she chose to reveal it is at the city council meeting before the settlement is announced. She's like, my name is Mary Ruth Reyes, like she's reclaiming her name for herself. She's reclaiming her identity. And the reason that really stuck with me is because there's a line early in the film where she says she's tired of being Amy Smith, and she's tired of being known as something that she's not, as being a person that she's not. She's not being recognized, and she doesn't want to continually have live under a name that isn't hers. So talk to me about we talked a bit about the maturity and the growth of Marina and Hannah at the beginning, but talk to me about Mary Ruth, because she was interesting, because for almost the entirety of the film, you're showing her painting, and we don't get to see what this painting is until the very end. Whereas for the others, we get to see them doing different things. We get to see them going to meetings. We get to see them going to speaking to the lawyers. Speaking at council meetings and going to advocacy town hall meetings and such. Whereas for Amy, when she's Amy Smith, we see her painting. So talk to me about that creative choice as a filmmaker, and about choosing to portray her and show that particular element of her side in the film, because I thought it was a really interesting juxtaposition as from a creative perspective.
So Mary, it took me a while to get in touch with her. When I first started filming with Marina and Hannah, Jenny told me that Amy Smith, the anonymous first plaintiff, the one who was the reason the whole case happened, that she would be interested in meeting with me and was ready, to maybe start thinking about coming forward. But it took a long time. I think it took about a year for my first sort of email interaction with her until we actually met, and she was not comfortable filming so much, and she was not really, doing these public things like Marina and Hannah. She didn't go to these events and speak in public, but what she did do was that she was painting. She painted as a way of kind of processing and like shutting out thoughts, and the way of it's like healing for her. And so she told me, if you want, you can film me paint. That's something that I feel more comfortable with rather than, going out and doing these things. And so I started filming her painting. And then you sort of see in the film that she gets like a little more involved towards the end. She You see her a little bit at the wedding of the lawyers, and then she joins this Amy's Army campaign with Marina and Hannah, and so I saw that she was getting more and more ready to kind of step out and use her name, and then she does end up revealing her identity at the very last settlement when the case was finally settled. And so when we were editing the film, I was thinking about how we could show Mary in a way that felt true to who she was, and that could also add a sort of a layer in the film, a more of sort of her art, because her art is really beautiful, and it also does symbolize all the women's fights and processes and healing. And so I really wanted to film her do one painting from start to finish, and use that as a common thread throughout the film. And so I asked her if she would be interested in letting me film one whole art piece being created. And then she said, yeah, I want to do that, and I want to set up all my paperwork. Like, I'm done. I don't want to have my police reports. She had all these documents that she had collected over the past 15 years, and she was like, I'm ready to get them out, to do something with them, and not keep them in a folder in my house anymore. And so that was a really beautiful thing that she did, and the art piece is really, really amazing.
It is. I love the revelation of what the painting was at the end. And when she, like, at the beginning, you show her cutting up the files and documents, and she's doing like paper mache on the canvas. And I'm wondering, I wonder what she's making, and like you can't
Yeah.
really envision it. So, and then the revelation of what it is, I thought it was a really profound thing because it's about sisterhood and community, and like the family that they've built up. So for you, tell me what was it like for you when you stood back and you got a full look at this painting and what it actually symbolized and what it actually meant to her personally. Like, what was your first thought and like how did you were just like, wait, okay, so this is it.
Yeah, I was really surprised because I saw her make it, and I saw like every, and I filmed myself, so I saw it all through my camera. I saw her do her things, and I, very close up on all the paintbrush and the paper and the paper mache, and so when I saw her finish it and turning it over and putting the two canvases next to each other, it was really, I was really surprised because I wasn't expecting it, but it really is like a beautiful painting that kind of shows these women leaning on each other, being kind of on top of the stack of papers. And so I thought it was really it was a really beautiful moment. And it was the I think it was the very last thing I shot for the film. My final shoot day was like, that's a wrap after that. And it was just the perfect way of ending 4 years of filming.
And because the process took so long and it is on such a very heavy subject matter, and like there's moments where the women are crying and like they're revealing very intimate things and very traumatic passes, knowing that is for a film that is going to be seen by so many people, not only at the film festival but just in general. Like, what was the process for you and them in talking about this and like being so open on camera? Because it's different, especially for them, because like court documents are public domain, yes, but like you see the names, but you're not seeing the faces, and like these women are revealing their faces on camera and it's being recorded. Like, what was the process like for you in gaining their trust and comfort to do that? And was there perhaps, did you have a counselor on staff to like just like be there for them to offer them that kind of support?
I think being a part of a film like this is like a really, it's really difficult, and I'm really in awe of all the women who are chose to participate because, like you said, one thing is being a part of the lawsuit, but going on camera, talking about it, then having that kind of edited together, put out into the world for anyone to see is a completely different thing. And so it was, I knew going into it that it was going to require a lot of care. I think for me, it was important in the, when I tried to find out if any, who wanted to be filmed for this film, that it had to be someone who were emotionally in a place where they felt like it would be healing for them rather than re-traumatizing. And both Marina and Hannah, they reached out to me and wanted to be a part of the film. And it was important for me to make sure that they had kind of a good support system around them. Both had done a lot of therapy. They had emotional support. They had family or friends around them, and so that was it was important to me. I knew that I had to, if I was going to do this, I had to, it had to be with someone who was in a place mentally that they would be able to do these things and film. And so with Marina and Hannah, it took a long time for us to just get to know each other. And after a while, I think we started going into kind of more emotional things. But at the beginning, I joined and filmed more kind of advocacy work where they were out in the world doing, talking publicly. And then we did interviews with the other survivors who are plaintiffs in the lawsuit. And we did offer mental health support if people needed to talk to someone after. But it's an incredibly difficult subject matter. And yeah, it's a fine kind of balance in knowing how to frame questions and what to ask questions about or not. I deliberately never really asked about the assaults. Like, I didn't ask people to tell me about what happened to them. If people wanted to share, they could. But for me, I wanted the focus to be on their experience with the lawsuit and being a part of the lawsuit and kind of their experience with the system. Yeah, but it requires a lot of care to do a film like this.
And so the settlement happened in 2021, and it's now 2024 that the film is showing at South by Southwest. Could you talk about what happened, what took place in the years between? Because I was wondering, like, why this year it was released instead of, say, perhaps 2022 or 2023.
Oh, the first settlement was 2021, but the final one was 2022. The one with the police department. So that was sort of the end of it. And then we kept filming with and did interviews after with the other plaintiffs and still some, filming with Marina and Hannah and Mary. And I think, part of the reason why we weren't able to finish it the year before was funding. We needed money to edit and all of that. And so we needed to make sure that we had production grant and were greenlit in order to edit. And so that made it so that we had to finish it last year. And then I had a baby in last year, so that also kind of delayed things a little bit. But now we're done and it feels good.
And you mentioned funding just now. Could you talk about getting funding for this documentary in particular? Was it a bit more difficult, you would say, for this one than for other films you've done before? And could that have had to do something to do with it talking about not only sexual assault and rape, but also about a legal case, a legal matter, and it's about them suing the city, and suing the district attorneys who, again, in my research, I read that she dropped out of the race because they were at during I think it was in early 2021 as well. They were running, they had the campaign for a new district attorney, and she dropped out. So, like, yay for her, she needs to go. But like, talk to me about the process of getting funding for a documentary like this, and how that, especially because it lasted so many years.
Yeah, I would say that we were very fortunate to get a lot of support from the Norwegian Film Institute. I am Norwegian, and my production company is the main producer of this film, and the Norwegian Film Institute is really amazing and decided to support this project from a really early stage when it was still sort of just like me trying to figure out what it is. And so they've been incredibly supportive throughout the whole process and kind of let us kept giving us grants so that we could keep following the project or the process, I mean, of the lawsuit. It was interesting to me fundraising wise that it was hard to raise funds in the US for this film. I think part of that is because I am not American, and so I think I'm not, a known filmmaker in US documentary circles, and it is really hard to get funding for docs in the US for US filmmakers. So that kind of makes sense. But we were able to get funding from European and Norwegian grants. And then we also were able to have a co-production with the French-German broadcaster NDR Arte, which is a big public broadcaster. And that was really amazing because they would pitch the film at a forum, and they saw it and they were like, this is really relevant for audiences in Germany and France, which I was like, wow, they want the film from Austin. And so I think when that happened, I realized that this has like really big potential for viewers, not just in the US, but in Europe and globally.
Yeah, for sure. Because as I mentioned, like it's an issue that's prevalent all over the world, you know, where crimes against women are not taken seriously at all, because mainly because the world that we live in is patriarchal, you know, and like things that happen to women as young girls are not taken seriously at all. And so one of the last things I want to ask you, so the film is gonna like South by Southwest does take place in Austin. What has been the preparation like for you and the ladies with regards to the approach with the film showing there in particular? Because this is their home base, you know, this is their home city. And as I mentioned, like some of them went by pseudonyms like Mary Ruth and like, you know, Hannah, she didn't let like she like people know her from like within the circle of like going to the police departments and stuff, but now the city, people within the city are going to see her face and learn about something that happened to her. Have you had any discussions with them about that in particular, like in preparation for the film showing at the festival?
Yeah, I think they're all actually very, very excited that it's going to screen at South by Southwest. I think it's very meaningful that the world premiere of the film is in Austin, because it is the city where, the lawsuit took place. And one, it makes it possible for a lot of the women and advocates and people in the community to be there and kind of be a part of it. And then, of course, the women, they sued the city of Austin. So it's really, I think it's quite powerful that it now gets to screen for such a high-profile event in Austin. And it also does, screening in Austin also allows to get, more media attention to the case and to what the plaintiffs did. So they're all really excited. And I think all of them have been quite outspoken since the lawsuit. Hannah is now working with Austin Police Department and trying to overhaul their sex crimes unit. And so I think that they just see this as an opportunity to get more people in Austin aware of the changes that are happening this amazing thing that they did. Because I still think that there are people in Austin who haven't heard about the lawsuit despite everything that happened. And so this will be a
Yeah.
chance for them to learn about it.
Yeah. Have they seen it already? Have they seen the film already?
Yes, they have.
And what kind of reactions did they give to you about the film?
I mean, I think it's quite emotional for them to see it. They have seen multiple cuts of the film for the last almost 6 months, 9 months. Yeah. So it's been important for me to kind of involve them in the editing process because it is their lives and their experiences, and I really wanted to reflect, feel true to them. And of course, they would want the film to be, 3 hours long, so it can include everything and all the things that they did because we filmed so much. I think with Hannah and Marina, I think we had like 40 or 50 shoot days each. There's just like tons of material. I joined them for everything, and only a little fraction of it gets to be in the film. But I think they're very happy with the film and excited for it to reach audiences.
Yeah, we're gonna I'm wrapping up, but I think one of the things that I think is all special about documentaries is that how you're always just because you documentary spend so much time with their subjects, you're always there for like you're just like filming on a regular day, but then something amazing happens, like the day that you're that there's a day you were with Marina where she at first learns that her case gets dismissed, but then another day, like she gets the news that the case is going to settle and that they've basically essentially won. And I just always find it curious that filmmakers and documentarians in particular just get to be there for those very particular moments. So is there any, for my final question I want to ask you, is there anything that perhaps that didn't make it into the film that you'd like to talk about, like a day day in particular, or maybe something that someone said that really stuck with you and that really made you really maybe stop and pause and say, wow, it's like a light bulb moment, but just because of timing and everything, you couldn't fit it into the film.
Wow, there's so much. Oh, there's just so many things. I was like, oh my gosh, I wish that could have been a part of the film. I would say there is a really emotional moment that was not a part of the film, but when they have the DA settlement, the Jose Garza settlement, there was a vote as well where they had, there had to be a public a vote. And they all had to sit and listen to those that voting, and all the women were in the room, and they were really anxious, and it was so emotional when they learned that the settlement was approved. And we included in the film in earlier versions, but then we found that people thought the film was over because they were like, "Oh, they won! They actually won. It's done." And so we realized that we did have to not include that particular moment because it was so powerful
Right.
that people thought it was over. So we had to kind of save the emotions for the very final settlement with the in the city council with the police department.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, there was a moment in the film that like, is it done? But then you add on like basically like, epilogues where you showed what where like they are now in their lives. But again, thank you so much, Julie, for talking with me. But most importantly, thank you for making this film. And I hope it really does start an important discussion in not only in Austin, but in like countries for like where other people at the festival are gonna see it. And like just like amazing job done. I love the way you constructed the film and I love the time and the space you give to the women to talk. So like a great thank you so much for talking with me and for doing the film.
Thank you so much for having me. It
Oh, thank you. Oh my gosh, my eye is burning me. I'm so
was great.
Oh, wait, where was I?
You.
No, thank you so much.
All
Okay, bye. Have a good day.
right, bye. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
So, everyone, that was another episode of Carolyn Talks. And this episode, I spoke to filmmaker Julie Lynn Lillister to talk about her film, An Army of Women, a documentary that premiered at the 2024 South by Southwest Film Festival. It's an important documentary, and I hope it's going to become available on different platforms, maybe on Vimeo, where people will be able to see it and really learn not only about advocacy, but as a collective but personal advocacy for people who've suffered traumatic events and just like giving space to victims and like giving time to victims to be who they want to be in the moment, as in like give them time to grieve. And like the film really does do that. And I hope the film really does serves as an inspiration for so many people who see it. And again, thank you so much to Julie for taking the time to speak to me. And even though I didn't get to speak to any of the women involved in it, but again, like thank you so much to like Marina and Hannah and Mary Ruth and Amanda and Kelly and all of these women. And of course, the two lawyers, Elizabeth and Jenny, who like spent all of these years dedicated to staying true to this case. So like, thank you so much to them, even though they don't know me, I'll say that. And thank you to all of my listeners for listening to Carolyn Talks. If you're a new listener, welcome. And I hope you enjoy this and you listen to other episodes that I've done for Carolyn Talks, but also for So Here's What Happened, which I'm calling like my umbrella podcast. And for my veteran and dedicated users, thank you so much for sticking around with me for such a long time. I've been doing this for a few years now, and I'm very proud of myself for staying true to this and for persisting even when things get difficult. This work is not easy by any means, especially as a freelancer. If you've been paying attention to the industry, you will see what's been going on with North American outlets just being slashed left, right, and center. The work that I do for my podcast on my YouTube channel is not paid. I am not paid for any of that, but I do it because I genuinely believe in what I'm doing and in the filmmakers and the stories being told. And I'll keep doing it as long as I enjoy doing it. And I feel that I have something important to say and to offer to filmmaking into filmmaking industries and to filmmakers and to audiences and to people like me, just a regular person. I don't want to ramble too long. That's something I tend to do. I'll try to do better at that. And so you can go on YouTube and find the video version of this on my YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/ Saying Carolyn underscore Hines. That's HINDS. Find me on Twitter and Instagram at Carrie, CNH12, that's CARRIE, CNH12. Go to my R3 page. You can find links to all the podcast episodes, all of my published work, that's editorials, written interviews, podcasts, of course, but like film analysis, film reviews, TV reviews, and whatnot on there as well. That's r3.com, AUTHORRY.com. All of that's going to be in the description box as well as a link to my PayPal. Because as I mentioned, I'm a freelancer. Things have been very difficult for all of us in the last few years, but especially the last 6 months, beginning with the strikes in Hollywood, it has been very difficult for all of us. And for me, I haven't been getting as much paid commission work as I would like to have and as I need to survive. So I'll add my PayPal link there if you'd like to donate to the cause. That is Carolyn. It is greatly appreciated. And so I'll end here. So until the next episode of Carolyn Talks, everyone, stay safe. Bye.